refreshing milk, tasty proteins, and heartening fats. They can be used to plow fields and transport goods and people, and their skin is a great source for leather. The usefulness of cattle makes them one of the oldest forms of wealth. If you have a lot of cows, you are doing pretty okay. Notes. If you're around before domestication, you won't find any cows, but you may find aurochs, the wild animal from which cows were domesticated, more than once, actually. They're bigger than cows, up to 2 meters tall, better muscled, and have giant horns, making them both the largest and most formidable animal ever domesticated. They appear around 2 million BCE in India, reach Europe around 27,000 BCE, and died out in 1627 CE. Auroch backbreeding attempts, using selective breeding to restore aurochs using genes remaining in current-day cows, began in the 1900 CE, but they were finally restored in 2033 using DNA sequencing done in 2010. End note. The DNA sequencing happened in our world too, and at the same time, though it's too early to tell if it will lead to eventual auroch restoration. End note. 8.6. Dogs. Also, wolves. Native range? Everywhere. Though wolves first appeared in North America and Eurasia. First evolved? 1,500,000 BCE. This is when wolves and coyotes diverged from a common ancestor. And 34,000 BCE, for the first domestication of wolves. End note. In the fossil record, there is a skull from around 34,000 BCE that is not quite a dog, but not quite a wolf. It's a disputed fossil. Some argue that it's a transitional dog early in the domestication process, while others say it's an early attempt at domestication that did not lead to modern-day dogs, which explains why it's so different. The text here suggests the latter reading. The earliest undisputed dog remains I could find reference to date to 12,700 BCE and were found buried beside a human, clearly indicating the presence of a very, very good dog. End note. Domesticated. 20,000 BCE. This was the first domestication of wolves that led to modern dogs. Uses. All dogs evolve from domesticated wolves. Sure, wolves are clever and cunning carnivores that hunt in packs and set traps to ambush their prey, but they rarely attack humans unless rabid or starving. Plus, wolves are where you get dogs from, so we will not hear any bad words said against wolves. How great are dogs? Besides being awesome pals, dogs are a great source of labor, good for vermin control, good for hunting, herding, and livestock guarding, and can also be used for food and pelts after they die, of natural causes, hopefully, after a long life of being an awesome dog. Plus, if you point somewhere, dogs can understand your intent and look to where you're pointing. Wolves don't do this, and neither do our closest extant relatives like chimpanzees and gorillas. In some ways, domestication has made dogs more human-like than any other animal. Notes. Farming will change your relationship with wolves. Until the invention of farming, humans and wolves can be allies, working together to hunt animals and sharing in the spoils. But after farming, wolves will attack what had become valuable farm animals, and they become adversaries to humans. Wolves and dogs were the first species domesticated before even farming was invented, and have actually been domesticated more than once. In some instances, dogs domesticated themselves. Wolves that were gentler, cuter, and less afraid of humans could get more food from them than those that were vicious and kept their distance. So there was a selective pressure on increasingly dog-like wolves, until they could be accepted into human society as companions. End note. Scientists believe that it's possible dogs did domesticate themselves as described here, but without actually being there with the time machine, it's probably impossible to know for sure. End note. An experiment began in Russia in 1959 CE, trying to breed dog-like animals from wild foxes by selectively breeding the tamest foxes with each other. In 4 generations, some were wagging their tails when humans appeared. In 6, they licked human faces and wanted contact, and in 10, about 18% of the foxes were dog-like, calm, playful, friendly, and solicitous of human touch. By 20 generations, this number was 35%. By 30, it was 49%. And by 2005, less than 50 years after the experiment began, 100% of the foxes were born tame, and the scientists now raise money to continue their research by selling the foxes as pets. You can do this with wolves in any time period. You can make yourself a dog. Wolves enter puberty around 22 months, so in a best-case scenario, with 10 generations, that's only 220 months, or about 18 years, to produce a pretty decent dog. Imagine how great it'll be to have a dog after wanting one for 18 years. It'll be extremely great. 8.7. Goats. Native range, Turkey. First evolved, 23 million BCE for the common ancestor of both sheep and goats, and 3,400,000 BCE for the wild goat ancestor, the Bezoar ibex. Domesticated? 10,500 BCE. Uses. Goats are a source of meat, milk, wool, and hide, and can be used as beasts of burden too. Like camels, their dung is dry enough to be used as fuel. Goat milk is closer to human milk than cow milk is, meaning we can extract more nutrition from it. Plus, it's lower in, sometimes challenging, lactose. It's also more homogeneous than cow's milk, which means it's great for making cheese. Goat's downy undercoat, called cashmere, is terrific for sweaters, but it's difficult to produce in large amounts. Notes. Goats are actually extremely picky eaters. They often won't eat food if it's dirty unless they're starving, but they're very curious and will try eating basically everything. Goats, like all animals except humans and a few other primates, have no sensitivity to poison ivy. Since they eat it willingly, a few grazing goats are an easy way to get rid of this plant. Just don't pet them or drink their milk for a few days afterward. The Bezoar ibex is a species of wild goat found in the mountains of Turkey, from which all modern goats are descended. 8.8. Honeybees. Native range, Southeast Asia. First evolved, 120 million BCE for bees. 45 million BCE for the first honeybees, and 700,000 BCE for modern honeybees. Domesticated, 6,000 BCE. Uses. Honeybees make honey, which, until you find other sources of sugar, is one of the few ways you have to sweeten food. It's also energy dense and easy to digest. Honey can be used as a treatment for coughs and sore throats, and can be used to treat wounds in a pinch. Honeybees also make wax, which is great for candles, seals, and waterproofing clothing, and can be applied to tablets to make a reusable writing surface. Honey lasts almost indefinitely without rotting, so it is a very easy way to keep sugar around. Notes. Finding wild beehives is pretty easy. Just spot a foraging bee and follow her back to her hive. Botulism spores can contaminate honey, which is usually no big deal, but infants can be vulnerable to it, so maybe keep your babies away from beehives. There are several reasons for doing that, actually. Honey has been harvested even before humans evolved, which is no surprise since it is extremely delicious. Primates like chimpanzees and gorillas use sticks to collect honey from hives. Honeybees went extinct in the Americas around 10,000 BCE, but were reintroduced by European colonists in 1622 CE. 8.9. Horses. Native range, the Americas and Asia. First evolved, 54 million BCE for the earliest dog-sized horses, 15 million BCE for horses big enough to ride, and 5,600,000 BCE for modern horse ancestors. Domesticated, 4,000 BCE. Uses. One of the most useful animals to domesticate, horses provide meat, milk, hair, hide, bone, drugs, see section 10.9.1, birth control, plus are useful in sport, transportation, war, and labor. The horse-drawn plow, see section 10.2.3, plows, greatly increases farming efficiency and is one of the fundamental inventions you'll want as soon as possible. Horse hair is used to make bows for stringed instruments like violins, and horse hooves can be boiled to produce glue, which has been used since at least 8,000 BCE. Notes. The horse was the basis of long-distance communication from their domestication all the way until the 1800s. Until the invention of the train, the fastest speeds horses could travel at were also the fastest speeds humans could travel at. Making glue is easy. When a horse dies, break up the hooves into small pieces, boil them until they dissolve, and add some acid. The stomach acid from the same horse is a convenient source. This will set into a hard resin, which can be combined with hot water to produce glue when you need it. The earliest horses were clever, dog-sized animals that evolved in North America around 54 million BCE. So if that's where and when you're trapped, while you won't be riding any horses, you are going to have some adorable pets. 8.10. Llamas and alpacas. Native range, South America. First evolved, cousins of the camel, alpacas and llamas have a similar evolutionary history, first appearing around 4 million BCE. Domesticated, 4,000 BCE. Uses. Llamas and alpacas are a source of meat, milk, hides, and fiber, and can also be used for labor. After other humans, beyond yourself, show up in the Americas around 10,000 BCE, llamas and alpacas are the only pack animal left, and then only in South America. Notes. Unlike most mammals, female llamas don't have a reproductive cycle, but rather ovulate on demand after mating. Nice. This makes breeding them slightly easier. 8.11. Pigs. Native range, Europe, Asia, and Africa. First evolved, 6 million BCE for early ancestors, 780,000 BCE for wild boars. Domesticated, 13,000 BCE. Uses, pigs give meat, hide, and, uniquely, toothbrushes. Pig bristles make a great toothbrush, which is great because human teeth are baloney. Here is the thing about human teeth. They're the only tissue we've got that doesn't self-regenerate. You cut your skin, it heals. But your teeth just sit there getting covered in plaque, which are food particles, which are unavoidable if you eat food, which you have to do to live, until they decay. Ridiculous. Notes. Pigs were domesticated from wild boars several times, including around 13,000 BCE in the Near East, and again in China around 6,600 BCE. If you're around before that, wild boar first evolved in the Philippines around 780,000 BCE, before spreading to Eurasia and North Africa. Be careful eating pigs. Their meat contains what you can call a unusually high number of parasites and pathogens, including E. coli, salmonella, listeria, roundworm, tapeworm, and more. You'll be fine, just make sure you cook your pork all the way through. 8.12. Pigeons. Native range, Europe and Asia. First evolved, 231 million BCE for their earliest ancestors, and 50 million BCE for earlier ancestors that are safer to encounter. Domesticated, 10,000 BCE. Uses. Originally domesticated as a food animal, pigeons became way more useful when we realized that they can find their way back to their home nest even when released from an unfamiliar location up to 1,000 kilometers away, making them useful for carrying messages. Up to the invention of the telegraph, 1816 CE, pigeons were one of the very few methods of rapid, long-distance communication available. Notes. Pigeons are the first domesticated birds. They're descended from the rock pigeons, which, like all birds, are descended from dinosaurs, a diverse group of animals that thousands of other temporal tourists have safely encountered between 231 million BCE and 65 million BCE in their FC-3000 personal time machine, and which you may also briefly and much more unsafely encounter should you be unfortunate enough to find yourself stranded in that particular time range. 8.13. Rabbits. Native range, Asia. First evolved, 40 million BCE for early ancestors, and 500,000 BCE for the modern rabbit. Domesticated, 400 CE. Uses. Rabbits are a convenient source of meat and fur. They're small, pose absolutely no threat to hunters, and reproduce rapidly. So don't feel too bad about hunting these defenseless, adorable little furballs. Rabbits don't require much space or food, and so can also be raised in the home for a convenient and inexpensive source of meat. The ease of growing and hunting rabbits may make you want to eat them exclusively, but heads up, rabbit flesh is super low in fat. Not getting enough fats is fatal, which makes it possible to die of starvation while still constantly keeping your belly full of rabbit meat. Variety in your diet, it's useful. Notes. The earliest rabbit ancestors evolved in Asia around 40 million BCE, but the modern rabbits you're probably familiar with, the European rabbit, appeared around 500,000 BCE in the Iberian Peninsula, where they remained until being introduced elsewhere by humans. These rabbits have since been introduced to every continent except Antarctica. Introducing rabbits to new ecosystems has usually gone pretty poorly. Without natural predators, rabbits reproduce like rabbits, hence the famous expression. That famous expression is, do not introduce invasive species to new continents, what are you thinking? 8.14, sheep. Native range, Western Asia. First evolved, 23 million BCE for the common ancestor of both sheep and goats, and 3 million BCE for mouflon. Domesticated, 8500 BCE. Uses. Sheep are a source of meat, wool, and milk, which is great for cheese, see section 8.7 goats. Sheep were the second animal to be domesticated after the adorable dog. Initially, they were bred for meat until 3000 BCE, when the focus shifted to their wool. Until silkworms and cotton plants started being used to make clothes, most people wore leather and wool, so the sheep is a very convenient animal to invent and then keep around. Notes. Domestication and selective breeding produced the super woolly sheep you're probably familiar with, so if you're around before 8500 BCE, you won't find any. Instead, you'll find the mouflon, the animal from which sheep are descended. Mouflon have short reddish-brown coats, a white belly, white legs, and giant horns. After first being domesticated in the Middle East, sheep spread to the Balkans in 6000 BCE, and by 3000 BCE were spread throughout Europe. 8.15, silkworms. Native range, northern China. First evolved, 280 million BCE for the first metamorphosing insects, and 100 million BCE for the first silk-producing metamorphosing insects. Endnote. While the date for the first metamorphosing insects matches up with our knowledge, I couldn't actually find a date for when silkworms first evolved. And endnote. Domesticated, 3000 BCE. Uses. Silkworms spin cocoons made of silk thread, which you can weave with the instructions in section 10.8.4. Silk's popularity has resulted in silkworms being one of the few insects to be domesticated. Notes. Domestication didn't work out too well for the silkworms, though. Those that emerge from their cocoons do so without the ability for sustained flight and will not eat unless fed by humans. They live for only a few days, during which they mate and lay eggs before dying. 8.16. Turkeys. Native range, North and Central America. First evolved, 30 million BCE, which is when turkeys split off from chickens and other birds, and 11 million BCE for the earliest turkeys. Domesticated, 2000 BCE in Central America, and 100 BCE in North America. Uses. Chickens aren't native to the Americas, but turkeys are a pretty delicious substitute. Notes. Turkeys, like other birds, including chickens, can carry incredibly deadly diseases, including flus that can mutate to affect humans. See section 3.5 for more. 8.17. Beavers. Native range, Europe and North America. First evolved, 7,500,000 BCE for the common ancestor of the North American and European beaver, and 2,100,000 BCE for the bear-sized cousins in North America. Domesticated. Never domesticated. Don't even try to domesticate the beaver. Their teeth never stop growing, so they're just going to chew up all your coolest stuff. Uses. Beavers are A, a source of meat, B, a source of fur, and C, a source of cutting down trees if you're willing to wait and don't particularly care about which trees get cut down. Beavers excrete a substance called castoreum to mark their territory, so named because humans once believed male beavers bit off their own testicles, castrating themselves, which is not true, and really just tells you more about the humans who thought that than it does about the beavers. Castoreum contains salicin, which is an anti-inflammatory agent in humans, and can also be used as an analgesic. Castoreum smells like vanilla, and this beaver juice was first added to mass-produced food in the 20th century for this very reason, usually under the euphemism natural flavoring. Notes. If being trapped in the past has given you a headache, try consuming beaver castor sacs. That's where beaver castor comes from, and they're in cavities under the skin between the pelvis and tail. They're right beside the anal glands, so you'll know when you're close. Salicin can also be found in willow bark, section 7.27, if you've got some of those trees nearby and would rather not get beaver glands all up in you. The bear-sized beavers that lived in North America died out around 10,000 BCE, the same time humans showed up. North American and European beavers can't crossbreed. They've been separated for so long that they now have a different number of chromosomes. Evolution, it's crazy. 8.18, earthworms. Native range, worldwide, including Antarctica, before it became covered in ice. First evolved, 400 million BCE. Endnote. This date of 400 million BCE is an estimate because nobody's ever found a single earthworm fossil. But trace fossils, which are fossils recording evidence of their existence, such as their past in the ground, have been discovered, along with fossils of their eggs, which are laid in cocoons. And endnote. Domesticated. Never. We never needed to domesticate the earthworm because they already do terrific work for free. Uses. Earthworms move by forcing themselves into crevices. Baby worms can move soil 500 times their body weight, making them incredibly useful animals to have if you're farming. They aerate and mix soil, improve drainage, and encourage plant growth. They're a handy marker for soil health. Lots of worms usually means fertile soil that your plants will have an easier time growing in. In poor soil, you can expect only a few earthworms per square meter, while in fertile soil, there may be hundreds living in the same space. Worms work as fish bait and can be charmed out of the ground by tapping it rhythmically. Seagulls will dance on soil for this reason. Notes. An adult earthworm can weigh around 10 grams, which can put at least 1 kilogram of worm biomass per square meter of fertile soil. Multiplied across the size of a farming field, the weight of worms underground can outweigh the animals grazing above it. During ice ages, glaciers scrape away topsoil and wipe out any earthworms. In most of Canada and the northeastern United States, native worms died out during the last ice age, from 110,000 BCE to 9,700 BCE. As worms migrate very slowly, the worms living in these areas in the modern era are descended from non-native varieties brought over after European contact in 1492 CE. 8.19, leeches. Native range, Europe and Western Asia. First evolved, 201 million BCE. Domesticated, why would you want to? Uses. Leeches show up as a medical treatment in 500 BCE and continue to be used in medicine until the late 1800s. That's way too long to be attaching actual worms to ourselves, hoping they'll cure our diseases. They won't. Under the theory we have too much blood, we don't. We're mentioning them here in case you're around humans in this colossal length of time, during which they think putting a predatory worm on your skin to feed off you will help cure disease. It's unlikely to harm you. Leeches are full of parasites, but none that can survive in humans. But here is a true fact. It's not going to do you any favors. Notes. Leeches actually made a brief comeback in medicine in the 1980s CE, when it was found the anticoagulant in their saliva could be used in reconstructive surgeries. However, we soon found out which protein in their saliva had that property and generated it synthetically, and then we, once again, didn't need leeches anymore. So yes, when your civilization invents plastic surgery, you may have a brief use for leeches. 8.20, lice. Native range, worldwide. First evolved, 12,100,000 BCE for hair and pubic lice, showing up when humans did. 190,000 BCE for body lice, evolving only after humans started wearing clothes. Domesticated. Again, why would you want to? What are you planning? Uses. These parasites cover the world and were ubiquitous in human society until at least the Middle Ages. If there are humans around, you are probably going to have insectoid parasites sucking the blood out from your skull and then laying eggs in your hair, or lice. Lice species are closely tied to their hosts, and there are three types of lice that infect humans: head lice, body lice, and pubic lice. Head and pubic lice live in hair, but body lice live on clothing. Lice can also carry diseases like typhus, which has been responsible for several epidemics throughout history. You know how in old-timey paintings, rich Europeans would always wear those giant fancy wigs? That's because they shaved their heads because their lice were so horrible. Wigs could still develop lice, but they could be more easily sterilized in boiling water. Notes. Human lice evolved at the same time humans did. Humans were breaking off from their chimpanzee ancestors at the same time their lice were breaking off from their chimpanzee feeding ancestors, so there's no time period where you'll find humans and not find lice. Sorry. Most rampant plague outbreaks on Earth occurred during winter. Why? That's when wearing the clothes of a dead person is more likely. One single human with infected lice on his clothes could be responsible for a citywide outbreak of plague. Do not wear the clothes of dead people unless you boil them first, especially if they died of disease. 8.21, mosquitoes. Native range, sub-Saharan Africa, and now everywhere. First evolved, 226 million BCE for the earliest mosquitoes, and 79 million BCE for modern mosquitoes. Domesticated. Please, stop asking about domesticating human parasites. Please. Uses. Mosquitoes are a completely useless animal that also happens to carry viruses and parasites and can inject you with malaria while you sleep. A flying, swarming, blood ectoparasite that grows in water. Terrific. The mosquito is one of the few animals that, if removed, would have no lasting negative impact on the world. The activities they perform in the ecosystem, feeding birds some light pollination, are already performed by other insects. The only legacy would be fewer human deaths from malaria. Notes. Mosquitoes are found all over the world in every region except Antarctica, Iceland, and a few small islands. Oh well. They evolved before humans or even dinosaurs, so in any era in which you have either someone to talk to or something amazing to look at/be chased by, there will also be mosquitoes. Thanks, Earth. If you're in Peru, look for the cinchona plants, described in section 7.7, which can treat the malaria spread by mosquitoes. Chapter 9. Basic Nutrition. What to eat so you won't die for at least a while longer. Remember back when you had to worry about the dangers of eating too many prepackaged and processed foods? Great news. That's something you'll never have to worry about again. The story of nutrition is, yet again, one in which humanity took its sweet time to make even basic advances. It wasn't until 1816 CE that we realized proteins were important, and then only by noticing that if we forced dogs to eat nothing but sugar, they still died of starvation. Footnote: these experiments were done by one François Magendie, and if they seem cruel, then you definitely don't want to know about his vivisection lectures, during which he'd dissect animals on stage while they were still alive. This disgusted even his contemporaries, and here's a tip. They're entirely unnecessary. You don't need to perform either of these experiments. They're crazy. End of footnote. In 1907 CE, 4 years of experiments began in which different groups of cows were fed only one of the many grains they'd normally eat, which finally led to the conclusion that different foods have different nutritional content. We only started figuring out what vitamins were in 1910 CE, and while there were food guides created by Doctors Hippocrates around 400 BCE in Greece and Sun Simiao around 650 CE in China, it took until World War II, 1940 CE, for most nations to introduce food guides, created as a part of wartime rationing. Labeling foods with their nutritional value began only at the end of the 1900 CE, and even today, the food guides from different nations actually give different nutritional advice. So what hope do you have to eat well in the past? Well, quite a bit, actually. While specifics differ, the central tenets of modern dietary advice, defined by an era in which food, including less nutritious processed foods, is generally plentiful, have been stable for generations and boil down to 3 points. 1. Don't overeat. 2. Get some exercise already. And 3. Eat foods that are better for you, like fruits and vegetables. The first 2 points probably won't be an issue for you in your current circumstances, so let's add some detail to that fruit and veggies one. Your ideal diet will have you eating plenty of fruits and vegetables, because they're usually pretty good for you, even if they're not as tasty as a delicious steak. Eating moderate amounts of fats and oils, because they're less good for you, even if they are literally as delicious as a delicious steak. Eating a variety of food, because variety ensures you have access to the widest selection of vitamins and minerals, including the many micronutrients that you don't need much of, but which you do need to gobble at least occasionally. Eating a moderate amount of salts and sugars, because they make food tasty, but too much is bad for you. Not eating too much of any one thing, because too much of anything can kill you. Humans can even die from a water overdose, and we're not using gangster-style euphemisms here. Drink too much water, and you can die. You'll probably miss the taste of processed foods, seeing as they were exactly engineered to be as delicious as possible, but you won't miss the effects they have on your body. Beyond that, don't worry too much about your diet. Your circumstances will probably enforce eating in moderation and having an active lifestyle for the next several years at least, and it's not like you're going to be eating savory handfuls of breaded and cheese-stuffed fried chicken nuggets anytime soon. Footnote: actually, domesticate the chicken, section 8.4, produce bread, section 10.2.5, make cheese, section 10.2.4, and use the same machines you use to print on to press oil, section 10.11.2, and you can, in fact, summon these tasty treats again. End footnote. It is worthwhile, however, to read the brief primer on vitamins that follows, so you'll know how to identify and correct any accidental vitamin deficiencies that crop up in you or in others. Until 1910 CE, all humans knew about vitamins was that certain foods gave you different perks. Around 1500 BCE, Egyptians knew that eating liver helped you see in the dark without knowing what vitamin A was. And as early as 1400 CE, Europeans with no knowledge of vitamin C picked up on how fresh food and citrus kept you from getting scurvy. But sadly, in what can fairly be described as a comedy of errors, only not funny, Europeans, who generally like to think of themselves as being a pretty savvy lot, managed to forget and then rediscover this fact about vitamin C at least 7 more times over the next 500 years, including rediscoveries in 1593 CE, 1614 CE, 1707 CE, 1734 CE, 1747 CE, and 1794 CE, until the idea finally stuck in 1907. Footnote: how does this happen? Bad communication and bad science. Humans are one of the few animals that can't produce vitamin C on our own, but we're very good at taking it from foods we eat and storing it in our bodies, and can rely on those stores for about 4 weeks before scurvy symptoms start to develop. The catch is that vitamin C is easily destroyed by heat, i.e. cooking, and exposure to air, so processed or stored foods won't have any. In the 1400 CE, the fact that citrus prevented scurvy was known to Italian sailors, and some Portuguese sailors went so far as to plant orange trees on convenient islands along their way, but this knowledge was later lost. Rediscoveries were then ignored, as they went against the prevailing knowledge that scurvy was a disease caused by internal putrefaction brought on through faulty digestion. Lemons as a cure did briefly take hold in the British fleet around 1800 CE, but was lost in 1867 CE when the fleet switched from lemons to the juice of key limes. That juice has less vitamin C, and when it was exposed to air, light, and the copper pipes on ships, it was reduced to practically none. However, as faster steam engines had come into use over the foregoing half-century, the time most sailors were at sea was reduced, which, when combined with the better nutrition on land, led to fewer instances of scurvy and obscured the non-effect the new lime juice was having. When sailors on longer expeditions again began developing scurvy, and when the old citrus cure was apparently ineffectual, new theories took hold. Perhaps scurvy was caused by food poisoning in poorly tinned meat, or even by poor hygiene and morale. It was only when experiments were done on guinea pigs in 1907 CE, a lucky choice of animal since it's one of the few non-human animals that can even get scurvy, that Europeans, again, discovered that fresh foods and citrus were a cure, and this time it stuck. Scurvy has caused more death, created more misery, and had a greater effect on our history than any other disease that's so easily avoidable and so trivially, trivially cured. End of footnote. Vitamins are simply vital chemical compounds that humans need to live and can't synthesize on their own. Footnote: vitamin D is the exception here. Exposure to sunlight is all your body needs to produce it. Some K vitamins are also produced inside the body, but not by you. Rather, it's bacteria living inside your digestive tract that are doing the work here. End of footnote. While vitamins can have a large effect in your health and wellness, you need more than just vitamins for good nutrition, which is why even in our utopian era of rental time machines, we can't all just pop a vitamin pill in our mouths for dinner. Specifically, you also need carbohydrates and fiber, found in grains, fruits, and vegetables, proteins, found in beans, eggs, milk, meat, and which contain amino acids, fats, found in meat, milk, eggs, and nuts, and of course water. The chart on the following pages includes a complete list of vitamins, where to get them, and what happens if you don't get enough of them. Please absorb and digest this information carefully. So here we have table 11, which has three columns: vitamin, where to get it, and what can happen if you don't eat enough. Vitamin A, where to get it: liver, oranges, milk, carrots, sweet potatoes, and leafy vegetables. What can happen if you don't eat enough? Night blindness, which can lead to total blindness. Vitamin B1, get it in pork, brown rice, whole grains, nuts, seeds, liver, and eggs. If you don't eat enough, you can suffer weight and appetite loss, confusion, muscle weakness, heart problems, and involuntary eye movements. Vitamin B2, get it in milk, bananas, green beans, mushrooms, but know that the few mushrooms that are toxic can be really toxic, so be careful with mushrooms, almonds, dark chicken meat, and asparagus. If you don't get enough, you can suffer from a painful red tongue, a sore throat, chapped lips, oily, scaly skin rashes around your genitals, and bloodshot eyes. Vitamin B3, get it from meat, fish, eggs, whole grains, and mushrooms. If you don't get enough, you have to worry about the three Ds: diarrhea, dermatitis, and dementia. And by dermatitis, we mean your skin can discolor before peeling off. Other symptoms include sensitivity to the sun, aggression, confusion, and hair loss. Vitamin B5, get it in meat, broccoli, and avocados. If you don't get enough, you can suffer a chronic feeling of pins and needles, and or a chronic feeling of bugs crawling under your skin. Vitamin B6, get it in meat, potatoes with the skin on, eggs, liver, vegetable, tree nuts, which are basically every nut except peanuts, which aren't even technically nuts in the first place, and bananas. If you don't get enough, you can suffer anemia, which means your blood can't carry oxygen as well, which can make you feel confused and pass out, plus nerve damage. Vitamin B7. Get it from raw egg yolks, liver, peanuts, almonds, and leafy green vegetables. If you don't get enough, your hair doesn't grow properly, your skin doesn't grow properly, plus you can have abdominal pain, cramping, diarrhea, and nausea. Vitamin B9. Get it from leafy vegetables, beets, oranges, bread, cereals, lentils, and liver. If you don't get enough, your cells don't divide properly anymore. This, unsurprisingly, causes a bunch of problems, including fatigue, rapid breathing, and lightheadedness, all of which eventually leads to nerve damage, difficulty walking, depression, and/or dementia. Vitamin B12. Get it from meat, poultry, fish, eggs, liver, and milk. That means if you're a vegetarian, your only natural sources are milk and eggs, and if you're vegan, well, maybe take a glance at what happens when you don't get enough B12 and decide that, given your current circumstances, you can maybe bend the rules a little. If you don't get enough B12, you suffer all the symptoms of B9 deficiency listed above, plus your spinal cord can degenerate. Vitamin C. Get it in fresh food, including oranges and other citrus fruits in particular. If you don't get enough, you get scurvy. There's this whole giant footnote about it a while back. When you get scurvy, your hair curls, you bruise easily, your wounds stop healing, your teeth get loose, your personality changes, and then you die. Vitamin D. Get it in fish, eggs, liver, milk, and mushrooms. If you don't get enough, you can suffer rickets and soft bones, neither of which can be classified as good. Vitamin E. Get it in leafy green vegetables, avocados, almonds, hazelnuts, and sunflower seeds. It's actually pretty difficult to get a vitamin E deficiency, but if you do manage to do it, it causes sterility and nerve damage. Vitamin K, get it in broccoli, cabbage, dark leafy green vegetables like kale, beet greens, or spinach, and also in egg yolks and liver. If you don't get enough, red spots on the skin and or raccoon-like bruising around the eyes are in your future. This table is labeled Table 11. Some vitamin letters and numbers are skipped because we thought certain things were vitamins, but then we realized they weren't. Even as late as 1909 CE, this chart would still blow everyone's mind. If that column of horrible diseases doesn't convince you to eat your vegetables, and livers, oddly, livers show up here more often than you might expect, on account of how they're chock full of vitamins, then nothing will. Footnote. Some livers are, in fact, too chock full of vitamins. You should be using the universal edibility test in section 6 on everything you're eating that's unfamiliar, because if you don't, and you're stranded in the right time and place, you might eat some seal liver without realizing the risks of what you're doing. Seal liver has so much vitamin A in it that it can actually cause an overdose, which results in a condition called hypervitaminosis A. There's hypervitaminosis for vitamins D, E, and K, too. Symptoms include dizziness, bone pain, vomiting, vision changes, hair loss, and itchy skin that peels off. And it's not just seals. Animals that routinely eat seals, like polar bears, have livers that are toxic to humans, too, from storing all that vitamin A in the seals they ate. End of footnote. End note, this information matches recommendations from our world, including those made by the Dietitians of Canada. And end note. Chapter 10. Common human complaints that can be solved by technology. Technologies that you are totally going to act like you came up with all on your own. You are in a unique position. Very few people wake up in the morning and decide that today they want to invent civilization from scratch. Historically, most people wake up in the morning, discover that they're hungry or thirsty or bored or horny, and while trying to solve those problems for themselves, only end up inventing civilization by accident, if at all. In this section, we list the most common complaints humans have had throughout history, along with technologies you can invent to answer those very complaints explained from first principles. Conveniently, this also doubles as the list of the most useful technologies you'll need in your civilization. There are some obvious omissions that we assume you are already familiar with, including the wheel, because if you don't know what that is, you have no business rebuilding civilization from scratch. Footnote. Okay, fine, just in case, you can roll around with them, and they look like a circle. End footnote. Cooking food with fire. This was invented before even anatomically modern humans evolved, so if you can't figure it out, there's hopefully someone else around who can. Footnote. Creating fire in the first place can be tricky, though, So here's how you create one out of nothing but trees and ambition. First, collect material that you can burn easily, dry leaves, pine needles, the inside of bark, grasses, etc. This is your tinder, which you'll use to make a small nest-shaped pile. Then, collect some twigs about the size of a pencil, which burn hotter and longer than tinder, but doesn't light as easily. This is your kindling. Then collect fuel, dead wood that you can use to keep the fire burning indefinitely. The basic strategy is to find two dry sticks that look like they can burn easily. Place one on the ground, find an indent in it that you can force the other stick into, and begin rotating that stick while at the same time forcing it downward. Your goal is to create enough friction that things start to burn. This will absolutely take a long while, and it's energetic, tiring work. But eventually, the friction should cause the wood to smolder, producing a small, glowing ember. Transfer that ember to your nest of tinder, and then gently blow on it to encourage it to burn, adding more tinder, then kindling, and eventually fuel to keep it going. After you've created your first fire this way, you'll be so tired and annoyed that you will definitely never want to do it again. Instead, you'll work to keep those home fires burning. Hence the expression, keep your home fires burning, because it's a lot of work to get them going again if your home fires go out, and I never want to have to do that again. Once you have fire, you unlock the technology of cooking, which for humans functions as both external teeth, cooking softens foods, meaning you don't have to chew them as much, and as an external gut. Cooking increases the digestibility and absorption of many nutrients in food. Not all nutrients are increased with cooking. Vitamin C can easily be destroyed, so you'll always want to eat some raw vegetables and fruit. End footnote. And finally, we also assume you're familiar with the technology of French kissing, which, if you haven't tried it yet, you should give a shot. With the right person, it's actually not bad. Technologies are grouped by the human complaints they address, which allows you to peruse conceptually adjacent inventions. If there's something in particular you'd like to invent first, refer to the technology tree found in Appendix A. It illustrates which prerequisite technologies are required to unlock all the coolest stuff quickly. Finally, all technologies in this section include a quotation that's at least tangentially related to the invention under consideration, credited both to whoever said it first in your new timeline, that's you, and whoever said it first in our original and unaltered timeline. Feel free to plagiarize these ideas, taking all the credit for them when you pepper your speech with these bon mots. It's like you are soon to always say, quotation is a serviceable substitute for wit. Footnote, W. Somerset Maugham said that in 1931 CE, but you're going to say it way before he ever gets a chance. And don't let anyone tell you you're wasting your time when you memorize a quotation that speaks to you. As Antoine de Saint-Exupéry said, it is the time you have wasted for your rose that makes your rose so important. Hey, you should take the credit for that one, too. 10.1. I'm thirsty. Water can be found over most of the planet, but it's not all safe to drink. Charcoal can solve that by giving you a way to filter water, but it also has many other purposes, so many, in fact, that it's easily the most useful substance you can make out of some wood and a hole in the ground. But charcoal won't turn salt water into drinkable fresh water. For that, you need the technology of distillation. Besides desalinating seawater, distillation has uses in everything from civilization-building chemistry to purifying alcohol, which should put it right near the top of your list of food-adjacent technologies to invent right away. Please feel free to mentally compose just such a list while reading the following section. 10.1.1. Charcoal. Our spread over the earth was fueled by reducing the higher species of vegetation to charcoal by incessantly burning whatever would burn. You. Also, W.G. Sebald. What it is? A lighter, more compact, and more useful form of wood that burns hot enough to forge steel. Footnote. Wood usually only gets to around 850 degrees Celsius when you burn it. Charcoal can get up to 2700 degrees. End footnote. Besides unlocking cool metals, charcoal binds substances to its surface, which makes it great at filtering water and gases and mitigating any poisons you've swallowed. And if you're into writing or painting, charcoal makes a great pigment there, too. Before it was invented, you couldn't melt glass or smelt cool metals because your fires wouldn't get hot enough, which meant civilizations were restricted to a small subset of less useful materials. Also, good luck enjoying water with the unwanted sediment, tastes, and odors filtered from it, because that's not happening. Originally invented, 30,000 BCE, for cave drawings, 3500 BCE as a fuel. Prerequisites: wood. How to invent. Fire is a reaction requiring three ingredients: fuel, heat, and oxygen. Footnote: well, technically you need an oxidizer, but it doesn't have to be oxygen. But given your current circumstances, we're going to assume that when burning things, you rely on the free and abundant oxygen all around you, instead of on more exotic oxidizers like chlorine trifluoride. End footnote. Put any fuel, wood say, in an area with an abundance of heat and oxygen, and you'll get fire. But if you put wood somewhere where there's plenty of heat, but minimal oxygen, then instead of fire, a different reaction takes place. It's called dry distillation. And while less entertaining than watching the world burn, it's arguably more useful. In dry distillation, the moisture and impurities in the wood get evaporated away without the wood burning, leaving behind a pure version of your fuel, purified lumps of carbon. Footnote: how pure? Anywhere from 65 to 98% pure, depending on the skill of your charcoal maker. End footnote. That's your charcoal. You may find some charcoal produced accidentally in the remains of a fire, which is where it was harvested way back in 30,000 BCE when it was used for drawing on walls. But if you read how useful it is at the start of this section, you'll probably want to produce it deliberately. Since you're on Earth, a place where, in any time period in which you've survived long enough to read this far without suffocating, there is an abundance of oxygen, controlling your fire's access to oxygen is the trick. You'll need enough air to keep your fire going and transform whatever wood that isn't burned as fuel into charcoal, but not so much air that your fire spreads and consumes not only your wood, but all your newly created charcoal as well. One of the easiest ways to make charcoal in the modern era is simply to start a fire inside a steel container with an adjustable aperture, so only a small amount of oxygen is allowed in. Some wood gets burned as fuel, and the rest gets turned into charcoal. Easy, right? But if you need steel to make charcoal and charcoal to make steel, you stumble across a chicken and egg problem. Footnote: Section 8.4 shows once and for all which came first. End footnote. No worries. We're going to sidestep it entirely by producing charcoal from first principles, using nothing more than wood, fire, leaves, and dirt. The slacker way to produce a small amount of less pure charcoal is to simply dig a hole and start a wood fire inside it. When the wood's burning steadily, put on some more wood, this will be what hopefully turns to charcoal, then add a 20 centimeter deep layer of leaves, followed by 20 centimeters of soil. The fire will smolder underground, and 2 days later you can dig up your reward. But you're going to need more charcoal than this dig a hole and come back later technique can provide. You're going to need a specialized kiln, a single-use charcoal-producing machine. First, gather a bunch of wood logs, stripped of branches and leaves, and ideally already well dried in the sun. Use hardwood if you're looking for fuel charcoal, it burns hotter, and softwood if you want to filter water, it's more porous, which allows it to absorb more impurities. Footnote: hardwood generally comes from slow-going trees with broad leaves, like oak, maple, and walnut. Softwood generally comes from fast-growing evergreen trees with needles, cones, and sap. These are trees like spruce, pine, and cedar. Now you know. Now you can tell other people how to broadly classify trees and not have to fake your confidence in this particular matter. End footnote. Take a 2-meter-long pole and mount it in the ground. This will be the center of your pile. Using smaller logs, about 10 centimeters in diameter, crisscross them on the ground to make a grid, and extend this grid of logs out until you've got a flat and roughly circular area about 4 meters in diameter around your log. This is your platform. On your platform, place the wood that's to be turned into charcoal, packed as densely as possible. Longer pieces, up to 2 meters long, can be placed vertically, leaning against your central pole, with smaller pieces leaning vertically against them. Your goal is to construct a roughly circular mound, rising about 1.5 meters tall and filled as efficiently as possible with wood, with your 2-meter-tall post poking out of the middle. Once you've got your wood pile, seal it by covering it in a layer of straw or leaves and then adding sand, soil, sod, turf, clay, or other surface materials on top, building a 10 to 20 centimeter layer of this sealant. Don't forget to leave several air holes around the base of the mound. These are areas you can seal or unseal during burning to control the fire within those particular sections of your pile. When you're ready to burn, climb up your pile and pull up your central 2-meter-tall post. The empty space it leaves behind is your chimney. Footnote: If you don't think you'll be strong enough to pull a 2-meter-tall pole out of the ground, don't put it there in the first place. As long as you remember to leave a pole-shaped hole in the middle of your pile, you'll be fine. End footnote. Dump already burning wood or hot ashes into your chimney to ignite the pile. When you see white smoke coming out, your fire has started to burn. Over the next several days, the smoke will turn blue, then finally, clear. During burning, feel the exterior of your pile and open your vents if areas seem too cool, while closing them if areas seem too hot. You should never see red burning through any of them. You're trying to get an even burn throughout the pile. Fill any cracks that form in your pile's sealant layer to keep it intact. When is your burn finished? This depends on your wood, its moisture, the size of your pile, and how fast your burn has proceeded. Knowing the right moment is as much an art as it is a science, and it might take you a few tries. If you call it too soon, you'll make less charcoal than you could have otherwise. But if you wait too long, your charcoal will be consumed and turned to ash. When you've decided your burn is done, seal up the vents and chimney, cutting off all oxygen inside the mound to extinguish the fire. Let the mound cool. A few days later, you can open it, with water nearby to put out any fires that start once oxygen rushes back in, and harvest your charcoal. If you called it correctly, you can expect about a 50% yield of charcoal. 10 parts wood will give you 5 parts charcoal by volume, but with practice and skill, these yields can be easily increased from 10 to 5 to 10 to 6, and even reach 10 to 8 with an exceptional fire manager. Footnote, you'll never get perfect 1-to-1 charcoal production, because some of the wood needs to burn to provide the heat that turns the rest of the wood into charcoal. Sorry, the laws of thermodynamics apply even in the distant past. Note, the laws of thermodynamics do not apply in extremely distant times in the past, such as those before the Big Bang, but there's no wood there, so don't waste your time. End footnote. If this sounds like a lot of work, that's because it is. Managing these fires is easily a full-time job, and when your civilization allows for this level of specialization, you'll want to have people to devote their professional lives to it. If you want charcoal on the regular and have already invented bricks, section 10.4.2, and mortar, section 10.10.1, you can make a permanent version of your giant single-use kiln by using bricks instead of leaves and dirt, and leaving doors for access that can be temporarily bricked up and sealed when burning. When dry heating wood, the sticky resin and pitch contained within the wood will separate out, forming tar. Tar is great. It's sticky, it's water repellent, which makes it useful both as an adhesive and as a sealant, and it's particularly suited to sealing boats, section 10.12.5, and roofs against leaks and rotting. You'll probably want to build a different sort of kiln to generate and collect tar, something with a sloping floor that leads to an outlet to make collection easy. Not all woods have much resin in them, and trees that produce sap are best. Pine trees work great to make sealant tars, and birch bark tar was used around 4000 BCE to make chewing gum. Tars also contain antiseptic compounds called phenols that make them a convenient sticky bandage for animal hooves and horns. A final word of warning. Once the technology to turn wood into charcoal is well known, the usefulness of charcoal can induce people to cut down trees like crazy, which leads to large-scale deforestation. This happened in Europe in the 1500 CE, where a lack of trees in turn induced people to exploit harder-to-harvest but less scarce sources of fuel, like coal. Footnote. If you can use coppicing rather than clear-cutting to maintain a wood supply that meets demand, see section 7.27, you can also avoid human-induced climate change simply by avoiding the need for fossil fuels. While it's true that both coal and charcoal are carbon-based and release carbon dioxide when burned, coal releases carbon into the air that has been stored in the ground for millions of years, thereby altering the composition of the modern atmosphere, while charcoal and wood are only releasing carbon that's been stored for a few decades at most. While your civilization will reach a point when charcoal does not meet your energy needs, by then you may be able to leapfrog over fossil fuels to using fuels with fewer dangerous, ecology-destroying, ice cap melting, sea level raising, island drowning, and largely irreversible climate-changing downsides, such as biodiesel, vegetable oil, hydrogen, or temporal flux anti-causality inducer arrays. End footnote. 10.1.2. Distillation. Civilization begins with distillation. You. Also, William Faulkner. What it is. A way to purify or concentrate something made of two or more liquids by heating and cooling it, taking advantage of the fact that different liquids have different boiling points. before it was invented. It was impossible to turn a liquid into a more pure version of itself, a process that is actually extremely useful and not just for turning alcohol into more powerful alcohol. It can also be used for desalination, i.e. turning seawater into something safe to drink, and is critical in the isolation of chemicals, many of which you'll require very soon. Originally invented, 100 CE, as part of alchemy, which is when humans thought they could purify baser metals like lead into higher metals like gold, and maybe also become immortal and cure all diseases. This was doomed for several reasons, not the least of which were, lead and gold are different elements and not pure and impure versions of the same substance. Immortality is impossible when you've only got our flawed, aging, and failing bodies to build off of, and diseases are caused by a variety of environmental, genetic, and mental sources that no one cure could possibly address. While humans spent 4 millennia on 3 continents trying to get alchemy to work, in what can only be described as a staggering waste of human ingenuity, life, and effort from which almost nothing useful was gained except distillation, and even that took 1,000 years before anyone thought to apply it to drinks, you can do far better by simply not wasting your time. Footnote, we have an almost here, because in 1669 CE, an alchemist named Hennig Brand spent the fortunes of 2 wives trying to find a way to turn iron into gold. He thought that maybe, just maybe, you could make gold by letting more than 5,500 liters of human pee sit until it smelled horrible, boiling that rotten urine down to a syrup, heating it until a red oil came out, letting the rest separate into 2 parts as it cooled, one black and spongy, the other beneath it more grainy and salty, adding the oil back into the spongy upper part of his cooled urine paste and discarding the rest, heating it again for 16 hours, and then feeding the gases this produced through water. This does not make gold, but it does produce what Brand called cold fire, a glow-in-the-dark compound that contains the phosphorus naturally found in urine. This made phosphorus the first new element discovered since ancient times. If you want to reproduce this process, know that letting the urine rot first is a completely disgusting and unnecessary step, and that the salty part Brand discarded actually contains most of the phosphorus. Include it in your recipe, and you'll get a much greater yield. End footnote. Distillation was originally used in 1100 CE for delicious beverages. Prerequisites: fire, wood or metal to make a barrel, metal bowls, see section 10.4.2, kilns, smelters, and forges, and something to distill. Alcohol, section 10.2.5, is a good place to start. How to invent. We said you need a barrel, but really you want to remove the top and bottom from your barrel, so it's just a tube. Put the liquid you're interested in distilling in a bowl, ideally as wide as your barrel, which will be placed over a fire. Put your barrel on the bowl. Now, at the top of the barrel, put another bowl, which you'll fill with cold water. As your liquid in the bottom bowl boils, the vapor will travel up, hit the bottom of the cold bowl, and condense, just like water does on the glass of a cold drink. All you need now is to add a smaller third bowl to catch the condensed liquid that drips from the top bowl, which ideally will feed the liquid out of the barrel through a hole. This saves you from having to open your barrel and remove the condensation every few minutes before it evaporates again. That's distillation. What you're doing is capturing steam, turning it back into liquid, and removing the liquid from heat. And the barrel is optional. It's used to prevent steam from escaping and therefore increase the efficiency of your distillation, but really all you need are 3 bowls. A hot one to boil liquid in, a cold one to cool down your steam, and a regular one to catch the condensed steam and remove it. Here we have figure 13 showing a distillation still. You have the cold water bowl at the top, the collection bowl in the middle, and the liquid being distilled, being heated from the bottom. Steam rises up, cools at the top, falls into the collection bowl, and drips out of your still. It's labeled Figure 13, an illustrative schematic, distilled down to its core elements. Distillation works because different liquids have different boiling points, and the vapor from boiling a mixture of liquids will have a different ratio of its constituent parts than the liquid it came from. It'll contain more of the liquid that has a lower boiling point. Footnote: it's a common misconception that the liquid with the lowest boiling point boils first as the mixture gradually gets hotter, but that's not what happens. A mixture of several liquids actually has just one boiling point rather than several, but when it boils, the liquid with the lowest boiling point adds more of itself to the vapor produced, so condensing that vapor provides a more distilled liquid. End footnote. By distilling repeatedly, you can produce a progressively more pure version of the liquid with the lower boiling point. If you're in a cold area, You can distill liquids without even needing fire. This process is called freeze distillation, and it's really simple. You just leave your mixture of liquids out in the cold,